Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is singer-songwriter and music educator Mike Montre. Montre's latest release with the Mike Montre Band is Love, Time, and Mortality. In this conversation, Montre discusses his somewhat unconventional journey through the music industry, what he's learned from teaching music, and what happens when creativity outpaces skill level. That's on Into Music, coming up now. When did you become aware of music?
Well, aware, I mean, it was a big part of like growing up for me, studying or performing kind of way, in like something that was always around kind of thing. My mother was a musician who did like classical piano, taught piano, and was an avid listener of music, as was my father. So it was constantly there. But one thing that I really do remember that I've been thinking about recently, actually, is that I used to like, it's gonna be hard to explain, but like I used to try to like sing songs that I was like making up in my head, but in the way that I was hearing them, like on the radio, like the dramatic element of it. So like, say there was some like highly dramatic, like ballad type song, you know, of like the 80s when I was growing up, some Bryan Adams song or something like that. And I would try to like imitate that inflection of it and like just make up like sound, like the words wouldn't even necessarily make sense. You know what I mean? But that was going on at a very young age. I think it just was more so like sounds of music pouring in general.
I don't know. When I was a kid, I was just really fascinated by sound. And so I would sometimes, you know, just go throw like rocks at the railroad tracks. And sure. I'd get that clink. And I'd like try to imagine that again, like in the context of music that I was hearing, you know? Yeah, so I get that, yeah.
No, it's interesting. You know, it's very, I don't think we truly realize how much sound, musical or not even, it impacts us as we like are young, like in how we like hear it and what that means, because you hear that sound, you know, that kind of stuff.
So given that your mom was a piano teacher, did she give you lessons?
She did not. I didn't really, when I was younger, in I think it was fifth grade, I started to play the trumpet, and that didn't go really well. I wasn't that interested in it. And I didn't really do anything like in a formal way until much later, until my mom bought me a guitar when I was 16. It was kind of a spontaneous gift. There was no real like, I mean, I maybe had said in passing, like, I like guitars or whatever, but I had no like plan for it at the time. And I wound up initially just kind of kicked around. Maybe I learned a couple things through some friends. And then I kind of just got hooked on a few little things that I'd picked up, played it over and over again, and eventually was like studying jazz guitar for a year as I evolved into that. And then all I did was play the guitar for like 6 or 7, well, to this day, but I mean, there was a really intensive period in there. It was like before I had to, you know, support a child or earn a living and that kind of stuff, where I just sit there and like, and hole up and play. So it was that guitar though, that was the gateway.
That's so interesting, because so often I hear about people that they're like, you know, oh, I was just daydreaming and I was drawing guitars and stuff like this. And this was just really kind of an accident, right? This is
Yeah.
So interesting.
It's, Yeah, I mean, you know, kind of serendipitous. I don't know. I had that relationship with my mom throughout my life. So it's like not, she had a way of kind of like giving you something that she thought would be useful, but you had to kind of be the one to put it to use, you know, not like, in more of an indirect way. And I always thought that was kind of, and oddly enough, or maybe not oddly enough, but as an extension of that, it was that guitar. So that guitar was a, it was an Ovation. Are you familiar with those kinds of guitars? The not the fiberglass back, right? I've been teaching music myself for years now, like privately. And that's a whole nother story of how I got into that. But when I started doing it about 20 years ago, when I started doing it, that was the guitar that I always taught with. And it was largely because I would do a lot of traveling to teach at that stage of my life. So it wasn't even performance. Like I have other guitars and stuff that I perform with and write with and that kind of stuff. But this one specifically was for that because the fiberglass body, it had a durability to it that like if you're familiar with guitars enough, you know that like you're taking them in and out of the heat and the cold and the constant like this and that is not great for guitars, right? Fiberglass seems to be less fazed by that. So then I'm like, now I'm like teaching music through this instrument that my mother, who was a teacher, gave to me with no real backstory to why. And so that's it was always like I'm like, all right, this is definitely something deeper happening.
Wow, so it's almost maybe in some ways that she recognized that this was like well, it's like a tool, right? It's like a hammer or a screwdriver that you're going to
Right.
use for your
Yeah.
craft.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. 100%.
It's amazing. So you're playing guitar 6, 7 hours a day. Obviously, you're kind of hooked on it, as we would say. When did it come into view that you wanted to write songs and kind of pursue this as a vocation?
Well, I think that the writing part was like right out of the gate. So even when I think back of like what I was talking about before with like the imitating of a song, you know, and like making something up. I was initially just making something up. Like that was for whatever reason, I was gravitated to that. So the thing that I used to do when I really would play with that level of like continuous playing for hours was I would immediately be trying to write songs. You know, and looking back on it, I wonder, and I'll never know the answer to this. A, yes, it's definitely something to do with my own penchant for like creativity, but also I think some of it was at least like the limitations of what I could do at that point. So like if I would try to learn some song, right, I'd be like, I can't quite get this yet. But I didn't have to get anything if I was making it up. So it's like there was like this thing where I could take things that I already kind of could do reasonably well and put them into a format. And then I would sit there and one thing that I absolutely did right out of the gate, which I think has helped me significantly in performance, is I would pretend that that's what I was doing. So I'd be like, I'm going to play this song from the beginning to the end, whether it was some song I was trying to learn or something I was making up, right? So even if it wasn't great, there was still this kind of importance put on the idea that I was trying to execute the thing from start to finish. Because there's like the old adage, and somebody who teaches guitar for individuals, where if you had 80% of the people out there that play guitar know how to play like half of a song, like they can't play an entire song. You know, it's the most common thing I ever see. And that usually when I get a student who's like trying to further right themselves, that's like the first thing I say to them is like, well, you gotta think about this, like you want to play this song, this whole song from the beginning of it to the end of it, like you're presenting it like a thing. And if that's your mentality, you start to do that, and it when the creative side kicks in, you also have this like organizational side, because you can't have, it's really hard to have one without the other completely. And I've worked with so many different creative people and songwriters, and you know, lots of people have great ideas that they can't ever formulate into something that other people can receive. And that's a tricky spot. And it's ironic too, because when you think of creativity, you don't usually think of that part of the mind. But that's how that all kind of came together for me.
I can't play pool. And one of the things that somebody told me is, well, the problem you have is that you can't visualize a shot. And I guess with playing a song, you're also kind of trying to visualize the piece as a whole, right? And that's what that's about, is like, start at the beginning, move to the end, and eventually you'll be able to start understanding structure.
Right. Yeah, that's a big part of it. Because if you think about all of the songwriters who've created such like iconic songs through a very simple forms of music, right? That's almost in some ways more impressive to me, because you had to like piece that thing together in a way that's probably been recreated so many times, then, but yet still stood out as its own thing enough to, you know, have that level of exposure.
I remember when I was a kid taking lessons, my teacher told me two things. He was like, okay, we're going to play. Don't stop.
Right.
And if you make
Don't
a
stop. Yes, that's a big one.
Yeah. And if you make a mistake, just do it again. He's
that's
like,
it.
Every time
that's
I make
good
a
advice.
Yeah, every time I make a mistake, he was like, every time I make a mistake, I just do it two or three times after that, and people will figure I meant to do it. So
there you go. It's perfect. It's but the don't stop thing, man, that's I can't say it, because the thing is, what I try to express to people, and this is true like beyond if you're learning to try to play an instrument, but even if you're just performing, is continuity and rhythm is what people hear more than anything else. Like if it's why I always say to people when they come to see us, the most important person in this band right now is my drummer. Whoever it is on this gig, like he or she is always the most important person, because I could sing a bad note, I could play bad notes on my guitar, we could mess up a song, and sure, I'm not suggesting that we want to do that or that no one in the audience notices that, but a significantly less portion of the people realize that than if the drummer just totally drops the ball on a beat and, like, you know, it's just like one of those things. Everybody there, from the people at bartenders to the, they're gonna turn their heads and be like, what just happened? And so when you're sitting there trying to play a song on your guitar, your right hand is basically your drum, right? That's your rhythm section. And if you stop, even if you played this song perfectly and for the last 30 seconds you made one mistake and you stopped to fix it, that's what they're going to remember. They're going to remember that happened. And it's hard sometimes to get that across to people, especially I find adults who hadn't thought that way in the past, because they're so used to getting things right that when it's not right, they feel an obligation to fix it, right? You know, kids are a little looser with that. They'll just blast through something, but that's what it is. So that's good advice. I'm glad he told you that.
How did you start teaching? Was this something where you're like, okay, I know I can make a certain amount of money at gigs, I really don't want to go lay brick or something like that, this is a way of doing this?
So I formed my first band in 2000, and the name of that band was Water, and it was named after the you ever see that Bruce Lee interview when he talks about water taking the shape of everything and like, be like water, my friend? That's a good one. So that was enough for me to want to name the band that. And it had like the three dots, the ellipses on the end. So it's like dot, 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 water. Like it was infinite. It was deep. And we put out a few records. We were like a little more of a jam band of sorts. Like we still were a song structured band, but we did more of that kind of stuff, and we played all over. This is both in Jersey, and went to some festivals, and from 2000 to like 2006. But at that point I was like in my early 20s, and I had just gotten a job, and I was working for a mutual fund company called First Investors, and I had various positions there. And around 2006 I decided I didn't really want to do that anymore. It wasn't appealing to me as a career. And that band was kind of dissolving just on its own. Like the people had gotten to different places in their lives. And I didn't really have much other than like the $8,000 profit sharing plan that they promised me. And So I took that and I figured, said, I'll figure it out. You know, I could book some gigs and whatever. And a friend of mine who played violin on one of my records said, you should teach guitar at my music studio. That guy's name was Dan O'Day. And I really, oh, I've seen him recently to tell him this, but because I was not, I was like, I don't know, man. Like, I know how to play and I'm sure I could get the point across, you know, but like, what experience do I have doing this? He was like, no, you'll be great. He's like, this, it'll be fine. And it was great. I went there and did great with this place. And then about a year and a half later, I got an offer to go out on tour with a band called The Samples, who are like a Colorado slash Vermont based rock band that were pretty big in the 90s and had a pretty big following. And they had the tour bus, the whole thing, and they wanted me to play guitar for them. And so I took that gig. But in the meantime, I had started doing contracted teaching work for companies like online that would like assign students to teachers. You know, you'd go to their houses or they'd come to your house studio, whatever. So I built up a clientele that way too. So I was able to keep that going, like while I was out on the road and all that. And so when I finally came back from the Samples thing and they stopped nationally touring like that a couple of years later, I focused more on the teaching, and then I formed this Mike Montrey band, and we still play all over. It's not like we don't go out on the road for like several weeks. You know, we'll go to some place, maybe Nashville, Austin, play a couple gigs, and then come back. Regionally, we play pretty frequently though, so it depends. It's not sustainable, unfortunately, to get in a car and just drive around and play music. I mean, you either have to, that either has to be all that you do. Like, you know, you don't have a house, you know, that's a, or you gotta like chop it up in small spaces and make money elsewhere, because there's not a ton of, it's not a ton of capital in this line of work, if you, in case you haven't noticed. So that's kind of the rough sketch. That's how the teaching thing began. And I loved it. I mean, I was really drawn to it because it really becomes about the people. Like, I've always kind of felt you teach the person. You have to teach the person. Like, well, I shouldn't say have to. Anything can work for anybody, who knows? But like, that's always like, because not everybody's going to receive information the same way. So if you have a method, and that's it, and you're like, this is what it is, you're probably going to lose people with that. Now, maybe to some people that's worth it to kind of get that across. But like, I always kind of felt like my job here is to help this person try to learn how to play music in some capacity.
Do you ever have students who you can kind of recognize maybe like their creativity is a little bit ahead of their skill, where they're more like you were, where it's like they really want to write songs, they really want to create music, but they just don't have the fundamentals yet. And so how do you approach that?
Yeah. That actually, I think, probably happens more than the other way around, right? Like, sometimes I'm trying to get, I'll have a student that's like, I think is really proficient, like they can really play. They have like very little interest in making stuff up, which is fine. Not everybody has to or should want to do that. Like, the world needs more proficient musicians. Trust me, I'm trying to hire them half the time. So it's a, it's a, it's, but to your point, yeah, like that happens a lot. And then you get into this, like, this kind of, it can be a little bit of an awkward space, right? When you're trying to be that person for somebody, like, it's almost like, how do you harness somebody's creativity, but give them like suggestions on how it could maybe be a little more formed, right? Without saying like something that you created is maybe not good, so to speak, because that's not what you're really trying to say. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, you need that. Well, I mean, listen, that's been going on. Like, so many artists have less. It's funny when you find this stuff out when you research people, right? But like, there are certain artists who have like a total handle on the whole thing, right? They'll go into a studio and it's like the producer is barely doing anything. They're almost just getting out of the way, right? Like, that's almost what their role is in that situation. But then you have others where like, they're doing like most of the producer's doing like most of the work. So they have these, this artist has these great ideas. And like, I don't know if you've ever seen that, it's a Quincy Jones documentary that's on Netflix, but it's really cool. But there's this one section where he's working with Michael Jackson, and Michael Jackson had so many amazing ideas, but he didn't like write music, like, and he couldn't like formulate it on like a staff or anything like that. He would just like sing these parts that he wanted to have an instrument play. And Quincy Jones was there just like doing the work, giving it to the musician. It's like, so you had this like kind of funnel through that. So, I mean, the answer to your question is yes, I have seen that a lot. And how you kind of develop that is you got to kind of deal with it with a little bit of sensitivity, you know, because that's something that somebody's like come creating. And the last thing you want to do is like crush it, because that doesn't just impact what they're doing then, it could have an impact on what they're doing later. And furthermore, who are you to crush anything really anyway? Because it's like something that I might find is whatever somebody else might think is the greatest thing they've ever heard.
Tell me about the work that you do with people with developmental disabilities and how you got into that world.
So that's another, and I feel like my life is a series of like serendipitous events with people and connections. Cause this was, I got, this was right in like 2020, COVID situation. So we're coming, so like the end of the summer, where we thought there for like a brief moment that it was gonna, the world was gonna reopen itself, and then like the fall winter hit and it was just everything shut back down, right? So we had that little like 2 month thing here in New Jersey at least, but I think that was pretty much everywhere. And I'd gotten a phone call from a man named Sesh Subramanian is his name. And I had taught his daughters guitar for a long time. One of them actually went on to NYU and studied music and is doing like music therapy work now. I still teach one daughter guitar. But he called me up and he said that he was starting this center for adults with disabilities and dementia and Alzheimer's stuff. His mother had dementia, I believe. And he used a guy who worked for Bloomberg for years, pretty successful guy. So he wanted to do this now, didn't want to do that anymore. And he was going to put his money into like doing this. And he said, I need somebody to run a music program there. And again, I was kind of like, well, I mean, listen, I could play and I could teach. I was like, but I haven't really done this. I did do a couple things once. I used to go to a brain trauma place and play music for the people there, but that was just like me showing up to give them like something to hear, you know. So long and the short of it, I was down to do it, and he didn't have much money to pay me to do it at the time. He's like, but I think this will grow, and it's like those kind of programs, which is something I've learned since then, and I'll get back to the rest of that story, is that they are, the states put a lot of funding into this stuff to give individuals in these circumstances things to do, you know, and they're looking for people to execute those activities and stuff like that. So in any event, I said, all right, let's see what happens, you know. And he's so it was like there was like two people he had first, and we couldn't even go inside because it was COVID. So we're in like this park, and I got this ukulele, and we're singing songs, and they were enjoying it, and it was great, you know. And then like 2 weeks later, everything else shuts down, right? We're back on the internet. And he was not gonna let it go though. He's like, well, you're gonna do it, we'll do it virtually, like we'll set this thing up as a virtual program. And he got all these people, because I don't think any of these other facilities were prepared for that. So all these people signed up, and now I'm doing a music program like on Zoom like this to like 20 plus individuals who are all joining and interacting and, you know, playing along, requesting songs. Like it was really great. And then once everything reopened, I continued that program, the virtual program myself. And then I go to the place that he eventually opened, and I do the program there too, as well as teach some of those individuals music. We actually had a concert where they played songs that I had taught them. And it's been great. I can't say enough. I mean, it's a great experience. It's great to like have that impact, but it's also great to like understand how people learn, because people learn in a lot of different ways to begin with. And then when you add into that, like individuals that have learning disabilities or developmental disabilities, how they learn gets even more, it's more of something that you have to kind of diagnose, break down, and like really attach yourself to get across what you're trying to do.
I find that the best situations, if I'm teaching somebody and we kind of develop a relationship, is that hopefully at some point I'll learn something. It sounds like you have that experience as well in your teaching.
I kind of feel like, that's kind of the case with just about everything, like with involving like the interacting with people, you know, like whether you're bringing somebody in to play music with you, or you know, working with an engineer to make music, or teaching somebody, it's like that's the part. I think, I guess, in some ways, I feel like we overlook that. We're like, here's the task that needs to get done. Here's the person that's going to do that task. Or in the case that you're teaching somebody, like, here's the student, I'm the teacher. This is the thing that we have to do, right? But then you realize as it's happening that that human relationship is informing probably more of what is happening and what you're going to take away from that than anything else that you're actually prepared to try to do in the more immediate sense.
You've been listening to a conversation with Mike Montre. Montre's latest release with the Mike Montre Band is Love, Time, and Mortality. You can learn more about the Mike Montre Band via MikeMontreBand.com and more about Montre himself as a music educator via MikeMontre.com. Our digital producers are Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Hugo Fan. Our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson. You can learn more about this podcast at KMUW.org, and we do welcome your questions and comments via info@KMUW.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.